from Uganda to talk to us on exploring the frontiers of African sexualities through statutory, customary, and religious laws. Professor Tamale, please.
Thank you very much, Chair. What I'm going to do is reduce the 35-page long paper, which is available with the organizers, to 15 points, a point per minute that I have. First of all, historically, the process of proselytization subverted, overthrew, and demonized African traditional religions, which formed an integral part of African sexual culture. Nevertheless, and despite the concerted effort to undermine its relevance to the African psyche, ATR currently exercises considerable influence on the populations, and the tendency is for a significant number of people to practice them concurrently, even if discreetly, with the messianic religions. This constitutes one of the inherent contradictions and hypocritical deceptions of plurality referred to in my paper. ATR is not located in a sacred text and cannot be isolated from people's holistic and everyday existence. In that sense, ATR can be viewed as religion plus, a modest vending. It is, as John Beatty tells us, lived, not read. It is experienced, not meditated. It is integrated into the life of the people. Wherever they are, their religiosity, their religion is with them, end quote. In other words, African traditional religions cannot be delinked from culture. That is why, for me, this debate about whether religion and whether you're for religion and secularism, the separation of religion and politics, or whether you're for both, it doesn't make sense in Africa, because you cannot separate religion in Africa from politics. You simply can't. So when you're looking for solutions, we have to look for solutions within that conflated, the two spheres that are conflated. So the paper points to some continuities between the Abrahamic religions and ATR, but also note a significant rupture between Abrahamic religions and ATR in that while the former often views the female body as the seat of sin, moral corruption, and a source of destruction from godly thought, ATR celebrates and valorizes the female body as a reproductive or sexual icon. The influence of the second point, the influence of messianic religions on African sexualities has been enormous. Traditional sexual practices that were informed by ATR and indigenous culture have been seriously threatened. In the paper, I demonstrate how the positive conceptualizations of African sexualities, including the African female body, have largely been negated and overtaken by the state-supported advocacy of the messianic religions. But far from suggesting that African cultural norms or ATR were universally egalitarian, I argue that many sexual practices that were acceptable in pre-colonial, pre-Islamic, and pre-Christian Africa were encoded with the distinctive tags of deviant, illegitimate, and criminal through the process of proselytization and acculturation. African sexualities were reduced to un-universalized, essentialized culture and integrated into the wider enlightened culture. Point three, in the paper I discuss the emergence of the newfangled school of natural lawyers who seek to integrate a distinctive approach of Catholicism into law and legal systems, breathing fresh life into anachronistic arguments against contraception, abortion, sexual activity outside of the heterosexual marriage, that is, for example, fornication, masturbation, homoeroticism, adultery, and prostitution, and sexual acts between spouses that lack reproductive potential. During the same period, fundamentalist doctrines also took root in Islam, with moral teachings and sacred interpretations of gender and sexuality similar to those of the new natural law. And despite the doctrinal differences between the two religions, they often come together. And here I'm talking specifically about Islam and Christianity in Africa. They come together and lock arms when defending conservative perspectives on sexuality. Such reinvigorated religious fundamentalism has infiltrated Africa via a highly organized, born-again evangelical movement and Christian groups, as well as conservative branches of various Islamic sects. Four, the adjective conservative, when used in relation to religions, masks the political interests behind the so-called traditional interpretations of the sacred writings of these religions. Our preference in this paper is for the term political religions instead of conservative religions, in order to highlight the current role of such religions in dictating African sexual politics. Several historical anthropological scholars have long erased the mythical line that tries to separate religion from the secular in Africa. Five, in this era of HIV/AIDS pandemic, political Christianity and Islam have especially constructed a discourse that suggests that sexuality is the key moral issue on the continent today, diverting attention from the real critical moral issues for the majority of Africans, such as financial security or the plunder, misuse, disuse, and misappropriation of public funds. Employing religion, culture, and the law to flag sexuality as the biggest moral issue of our times and dislocating the real issue is a political act and must be recognized as such. Six, contrary to popular belief, sexuality is not exclusively driven by biology. A very significant part of it is socially constructed through legal, cultural, and religious forces driven by a political economic agenda. Sexuality is very much a socio-cultural invention that is closely linked to power and to the processes of subjugation. As Africans, how we do and experience sexuality is heavily influenced by society and culture. How and with whom we have sex, what we desire, what we take pleasure in, how we express that pleasure, why, under what circumstances, and with what outcomes are all forms of learned behavior communicated inter alia through the institutions of culture, religion, and law. Seven, the need to control and regulate women's sexuality and reproductive capacity is crucial in patriarchal capitalist societies at two levels. First, as one of the central tenets of the institutionalization of women's exploitation, such control consolidates male domination through their control of resources and their relative greater economic power over women. It is essential that the man's acquired property and wealth is passed on to his male offspring in order to sustain the system of patriarchy. Hence, it becomes important to control women's sexuality in order to guarantee the paternity and legitimacy of children when bequeathing property. To this end, the monogamy of women is required, without necessarily disturbing men's polygynous sexuality. At another level, capitalist patriarchal societies are characterized by a separation of the public sphere from the private realm. The two spheres are highly gendered, with the former representing men and the locus of socially valued activities such as politics and wage labor, while the latter is representative of the mainly unremunerated and undervalued domestic activities performed by women. This necessitated the domestication of women's bodies and their relegation to the private sphere, where they provide the necessities of productive and reproductive social life gratuitously, that is, without pay, thus subsidizing capital, and are economically dependent on their male partners. Regulating and controlling women's sexuality, therefore, is central to the survival of patriarchy and capitalism. It represents a vital and necessary way of instituting and maintaining the domesticity of African women, with a link between women's sexuality and domesticity manifested in the regulation and censoring of women's reproductive capacity, behavior, movements, dress, appearance, and so on. 8. As part of the current legal regime, religion constructs and reconstructs the African sexual terrain with particular emphasis on public morality. I offer several scripture examples in the paper from the messianic religions to illustrate this point. Most of them find practical expression based on the patriarchal capitalist interpretations of the Bible and the Quran. Messianic religions are well known for their restraining influence on sexuality. Relative to ATR, Christian and Islamic doctrines and sermons, as opportunistically and patriarchally interpreted, encourage sexual purity and virtue, especially for women. Whereas ATR generally tolerated practices such as masturbation, fornication, infidelity, adultery, non-penetrative sex, prostitution, and homoerotics, the messianic religions condemn them as sinful. 9. The religious and political leadership further regulate and police African sexualities by highlighting their negative aspects. By keeping sexual pleasure in the background and foregrounding the risks and dangers associated with sexuality, practices of self-surveillance, particularly for women, are intensified. The concepts of religious sin, cultural taboos, and criminalization through legislation play a crucial role in constructing sexuality and the manner in which African people experience it, ultimately exercising a regulatory and controlling role. A good example of how religion conjoins with politics and law in constructing African women's sexuality is seen in the 2008 Nigerian bill for an act to prohibit and punish public nudity, sexual intimidation, and other related offenses in Nigeria. Clause 16 thereof provided, and I quote, "The roles of religious bodies in moral rejuvenation of our country is by this act hereby guaranteed. A, the ministries of information, cultures, and national orientation shall develop policies and programs for the integration of religious bodies in the reformation of the society for moral uprightness. And B, religious bodies shall be encouraged in teaching moral uprightness in its adherents." Point 10. Generally classified under the label offenses against morality, sex laws are enumerated in African penal codes prohibiting and or regulating various sexual relations. Not only do these laws universalize sexuality, but they squarely place issues of sexual morality between consenting adults within the realm of the state and the public. Such offenses are often prejudicial to women and seek to maintain their subordinate status in society. Most of these laws found their way into African penal codes as direct imports from the legal regimes of former colonial powers. Ironically, while most victimless sex offenses have been decriminalized in former colonial metropoles, African jurisdictions maintain the moral surveillance regimes with enthusiasm. 11. The offense that has sucked up the socio-political oxygen in Africa is homosexuality. It is an excellent example to illustrate how the messianic faith supplanted African cultural values pertaining to sexuality by labeling same-sex erotic relationships as deviant. In Africa, not only does the discourse construct same-sex relations boldly as unnatural, but also as distinctly un-African. Political religions and reinterpreted culture are the chief inscribers of same-sex sexuality as un-African and deploy it with the discourse of sin. Despite the existence of a respectable body of scholarship that suggests that prior to the proselytizing influence of the messianic religions, there was a general tolerance, even acceptance, of homosexuality in Africa. The hegemonic discourse persists. It is also worth noting that the homophobic gusts blow amidst rising inflation, high unemployment, corruption, repression, and increased hopelessness among the African populace. So whether it is the draconian anti-homosexuality bill in Uganda or the Nigerian same-gender marriage prohibition bill, all homophobic legislation around the continent enjoy populist support thanks to the hegemonic power structures. It was not accidental that the Ugandan bill was tabled in parliament against the backdrop of a conference to expose the dark and hidden agenda of homosexuality organized by a fundamentalist religious NGO called the Family Life Network and funded by right-wing American evangelicals. Among African dictatorships, non-conforming sexualities have become a metaphor for immorality and form an effective instrument in the politics of destruction. Instead of blaming political mismanagement and corruption for high unemployment, the high cost of living, and poor health facilities, the red herrings will crystallize inter alia in the form of the vice of homosexuality or the evil of prostitution. And the red herrings are usually fished out of the sea of morality when political accountability is looming. The irony seems to be lost on those who condemn same-sex relations as alien while simultaneously bolstering their arguments with foreign religions such as Christianity and Islam. Is it not, ladies and gentlemen, the mother of all ironies for a Bible-wielding African politician named David and dressed in a three-piece suit, caressing an iPhone and speaking a colonial language to condemn anything for its un-Africanness? You say I should conclude. Okay. And the rest of the paper, my points were about how sexual minorities have responded to this issue of denying sexual citizenship to certain groups in Africa. And this has been done through law reform, strategic litigation, shadow reports, even creative ways of resistance through poetry, literature, and so on. And finally, I talk about how we have got a group of scholars called African feminist hermeneutics that have started the work of reinterpreting the sacred word. Thank you very much.